I'd like to begin by talking about the fundamental choice we all have in professional life. Actually, it's a choice we also have in personal life. But today we're going to focus on business and professional life and the fundamental choice we have about being an owner or a victim. It's as basic as that. I can either take ownership for my life, my professional life, my success, my happiness on the job, or I can be a victim of circumstances. I can come from either position. When I come from ownership, my language changes, and everyone around me is drawn to me as a leader. When I come from being a victim, for some subconscious reason, people around me are pushed away. People around me are not as attracted to the ideas I have and not as likely to follow me. Let's talk about ownership and let's talk about being a victim. Sometimes they subtly come into our lives and infect our lives without actually knowing what's happening. But when we consciously choose to continue to come from ownership, then things get strong and things get productive right away. Being an owner and being a victim show up first in language. Let me give you an example. If I take ownership, and if I'm coming from that position, I will use a phrase like, get from. I'll talk about what I can get from an experience, what I can learn from the experience, no matter how trivial the experience is. It might even be a movie I've been to, and I can come out of the movie, even if I hated the movie, and I can say, you know, one thing I got from that movie was a new determination to never go to a movie that has both Winona Ryder and Richard Gere in it. So I've got a new film guideline from going to a bad movie. That's get from, what I get out of things, the lesson I take from it. Now, what a victim says is get through. What you'll hear someone who is primarily victim-oriented is all the things they have to get through. And they'll talk about that all day long. You can ask a victim any question. For example, how is your work life going? And they'll talk about trying to get through something that's going on. It's end of the month, we're trying to get through that. It's end of the year, I'm trying to get through that. We're going through a lot of changes at work. We're trying to get through those changes. Now remember, this language is constant. It keeps coming up. You can keep changing the subject, and a victim will keep using the language. For example, you ask a victim, how are things at home? Well, we're going through some tough times at home right now. We have some teenagers living at home right now, trying to get through that period in our lives. Well, how's your relationship? Well, we have our problems. We're trying to get through them. Well, how's your life, basically? I'm trying to get through it. But what bothers me is the dying process. I hear that's hard to get through. So it doesn't matter what you ask a victim. They'll always respond by talking about what they have to get through. Let's look at another language difference. This can be particularly valuable to you during the hiring process. Listen very carefully for how people use language, especially with unrehearsed questions. When you're hiring people, make sure that the question is something they don't have a rehearsed answer for. That's what I mean by an unrehearsed kind of question. Listen for the word life. If someone's coming from basic ownership, they talk about using life. The basic phrase or thought is, I use life. If you ask an owner, what are you going to use the rest of your life for? They'll have an answer for you. They'll understand the question. Now, what's interesting is, if you ask a victim, what are you going to use the rest of your life for? They won't have an answer because they won't understand the question. In a victim's mind, they use language this way, life uses me. So an owner says and thinks, I use life. A victim says and thinks, life uses me. Listen to a victim speak. Every reference to life will be negative. Life is unfair. Life is difficult. Life's a burden. Life is a curse. They'll repeat it over and over again. And when things go really wrong, a victim will say, that's life. Riding high in April, shot down in May. That's life. Every time something is really bad or wrong, the victim will bring out the word life, because the total mental internal reference to life is negative. I once had a woman come up to me in a seminar, and she said, "You know, I've always tried to teach my children that life is unfair. I've told them over and over, life is unfair." When they were going off to school, I would say, "Now remember, honey, life is unfair." Or if I was tucking them in at night in their beds and they had a little smile on their face, I'd say, "Remember, before you go to sleep, life is unfair." So I said to the woman, "Okay, what's your question?" And she said, "Well, I don't know. I'm just wondering, why are my kids depressed all the time?" And so I thought, really, that's because of how you're programming your kids. I didn't tell her that directly. I let her come to that conclusion. We program our children in a certain way, but what's even more important is that we program ourselves. Life really is not unfair, and life is not fair. Life is just life. It's what we make of it. And that's the basic position of ownership. The basic position of ownership is freedom. Freedom of choice. Really, what's different between an owner and a victim is that the owner understands the freedom of choice. The owner really gets it deep down inside. I have absolute freedom to think anything I want about anything. That's my basic fundamental human freedom. That's my free will. Whereas the victim never thinks that. The victim believes, I have no freedom. I have to think certain negative things about certain negative circumstances. I have no choice. Being a victim is being without choice, mentally, internally, psychologically. Being an owner is simply being aware of choice. It doesn't mean that we think positively all the time. It doesn't mean that we're just happy-go-lucky all the time. It means we are aware of our basic freedom, and we can use it anytime we want. I want to talk about a victim word that's really important now. It's the word should. A major victim word is should. Anything like the word should is a victim word. Any words of obligation, any words of duty, any words of trying to live up to other people's expectations, those are victim words. I should do this, I should do that. And one of the ways you can tell that someone's using a victim word is when they are losing energy. You can even tell it yourself. Ask yourself, have I ever fired myself up by using the word should? Have I ever gotten really excited and jazzed up and psyched up to do something because I told myself I should do it? The answer is probably no. It's not a word that gets people excited. It's not a word that gets their energy going. Ownership language is high energy language. It results in higher energy. It results in more productivity. Victim language is a drain on the energy system. Just listen to people when they use the word should. You can hear it in their voice tone. If you ask someone if they're exercising regularly, they might say, "I should," not as much as "I should," and the voice tone will give it away. Victim language actually leads immediately to feelings of depression, sinking feelings, feelings of trying to live up to other people's expectations. Whereas ownership language, when it's thought deeply and spoken, leads to a sense of power, a sense of control, not over other people, but over our own energy source. Let me give you some more language that separates the two. For example, an owner will say, "How can I use this? If something goes wrong, how can I use this? What can I do with this? If something goes right, how can I use this? How can I take this event, this circumstance, and this situation, and use it to gain a goal I'm trying to reach?" Whereas if something goes wrong with a victim, they don't use that language. They ask the question, "Who can I blame? Who can I blame for this? Who's responsible for this other than me? Who can I complain about? Who can I gossip about? How can I get on the phone and talk to other people about people who are doing things wrong? And that's the basic question inside a victim's head. It's a question about blame, whereas an owner is always looking for, what can I do with it? How can I advance toward my goal with this? It's a completely different life question that the two people are asking. Another interesting comparison between owner and victim is this one. The word commitment. The thought commitment. What is it to you? When you find out what it is to you, you can find out whether you're coming from a position of ownership or victimization. For example, an owner thinks of commitment as a decision. In the mind of an owner, every commitment in life is a clear and clean decision. I'm simply committed to that because I decided to be committed. Whereas a victim, a commitment is not a decision. A commitment is a feeling. Well, how do we know that? Well, just listen to a victim speak. They'll reveal that. They'll say things like, I'm not feeling as committed to my job as I used to feel. I'm not feeling as committed to my partner as I used to feel. To a victim, commitment is something that just comes and goes like feelings. Someday I'm feeling more committed, someday I'm feeling less committed. It's almost like stomach gas. Are you feeling committed to your wife? I don't know. I feel it sort of here. No, I took a pill yesterday. I don't feel it. And it's all about feelings. Victims are feelers. They listen to their feelings all day long. They take their emotional temperature all day long. And then they decide what to do based on how they feel. Do I feel like doing this? Do I feel like calling that person? Do I feel like talking to this person? Do I feel like getting up yet? What do I feel like doing? Taking their emotional temperature all day long and basing what they do on how they feel. Whereas owners do it the other way around. They base what they do on what they've decided to do, what their commitments are. So to an owner, a commitment is a decision. I'm committed to what I'm committed to doing because I decided to commit to it. A victim simply feels committed one day and doesn't feel committed the next day. So it's a feelings-based life, which is to say it's emotional immaturity. It's arrested emotional development. Victims are basically, to put it in a simple term, babies. Okay. The question then becomes, what do I do? If I have a victim on my team, if I have a victim in my family, what do I do? And the answer is basically this. People love to be inspired. The one thing that really works with other people is positive reinforcement and inspiration. One thing that does not work with other people is to correct them and make them wrong. For example, if I say to a person, you're being a victim. You sound like a victim. All your talk is victim language. They'll get defensive. They're not going to correct it right away. They're not going to say, oh, thank you. What else can I correct? They're going to say, no, I'm not. Or they're going to say, well, you're the reason why I am. They're going to defend themselves. Anytime we make someone wrong, they get defensive. They go deeper into the behavior that we're identifying as wrong. That's why there's no such thing as constructive criticism at work. Constructive criticism alienates the other person and makes them feel further away from you. The only thing that works is inspiration and modeling. If I actually act out what ownership is for someone, they become inspired and want to be that way. It's like what George Patton said. There are three principles of leadership. Principle number one, example. Number two, example. Number three, example. Be the example of what you want to see. Gandhi said something very similar. Gandhi was asked, how do we change other people? What can I do to change someone else? And Gandhi would say, you can't change other people. You must be the change you wish to see in other people. That's because Patton and Gandhi, two great leaders, both understood one very important leadership quality. That is inspiration. People love to be inspired. They love to get excited about how someone else is being and then copy that. They hate to be fixed. They hate to be corrected. They hate to be made wrong. They feel like a child when that happens. Inspiration is the greatest leadership tool in the book. The more you inspire your people with your own ownership, the faster they change without even knowing they're changing. So I want to take this to the job interview. I want to take it to the question of how do we hire owners and not victims? How do I surround myself with people who have responsibility, self-reliance, self-responsibility, a mature kind of loyalty to the company, integrity? How do I do that? Well, I want to give a couple tips here, tips that I have found really work when people use them. Number one, the most important thing of all is to spend a little more time in the job interview than you normally do. Add an extra 20 minutes to that interview. If you are going to talk to somebody for a half an hour, make sure it's an hour. If you are going to have a one-hour interview with an employee, a potential employee, make it an hour and a half. Because that extra 20 minutes, that extra half hour, is going to give you more information than the first hour ever did. And here's why. People during job interviews role play. We all do it. Everybody does it. We put our best foot forward. We try to impress the interviewer, and we try to anticipate what the interviewer wants in the interview. There's nothing wrong with it. It's not really false. It's not phony. It's really being the best we can be in the interview. Everybody does that. Now, the problem with it is we can't find out who the person really is. We can't find out whether we have an owner or a victim with that kind of interview. We have to let it go on a little bit longer. We have to extend it a little longer so the person starts to relax and you get the real person. That's when you get your gut feelings. I like this person. I trust this person. Or you get your red flags. I don't trust this person. There's something wrong here. It doesn't feel right to me. If you can add that extra 20 minutes, you'll find your team starts to look different. You'll have a much better team. You'll have less turnover. You'll have less absenteeism, fewer problems. Now, I know a lot of us say, well, I don't have 20 minutes extra. But think right now of all the time you spend with a problem employee, someone who came in under the radar and you don't really know how it happened, it just happened, they seemed so good in the interview. Think of how much time it takes to undo a problem like that. Time with HR, time filling out forms, extra time reprimanding, time putting a person on probation, all that stuff, all the nightmare, all the headaches. That extra 20 minutes could have saved you from that. So add some extra time. Here's the second tip for hiring owners and not victims. When you ask questions in a job interview, make sure that the majority of your questions are questions that they haven't had time to rehearse an answer for. For example, you could ask, well, why did you leave your other job? Now, they know you're going to ask that question, so they've got a rehearsed answer. Their answer might be something wonderful like, well, I didn't have enough challenges, I'm kind of a workaholic, I really love people and I wasn't interacting enough with people. All those wonderful sounding things that the amateur interviewer is going to say, oh, this is wonderful, I've got a great person here, but you really don't. You have a rehearsed answer. You've got the best face forward. And that's not going to help you. It's not going to give you the information you need. You need to keep asking. Okay, tell me more about that other job. In other words, there's a system, there's a technique called layering. Ask the predictable question if you want to, but then layer. Layer it with another question and say, okay, tell me more. What else happened on that job? Tell me more about that job. Where did you go to high school? Well, I went back there. What was high school like? Tell me more about high school. Tell me more. Tell me some more about that. What else was it like? That's called layering. questions that they haven't anticipated. So they've run out of rehearsed answers, and now you get the real person. You'll either get an owner or a victim. Listen very carefully for the language, and you'll get someone who takes responsibility for their own happiness, which is an owner. Basically, the definition of an owner, which is the employee you really want working for you, is someone who takes full responsibility for their own happiness in life. In other words, if you could take away out of their brain a little printout of how it's being programmed, it would say, I take full responsibility for my happiness in life. A victim, on the other hand, if you could get a little printout from their brain at the end of the day, the programming would read, I take no responsibility for my own happiness. A victim believes that their happiness is caused by outside factors. It's caused by how people treat them. It's caused by the luck of the draw, events, circumstances, situations, and all of that causes happiness or unhappiness. That's a victim position. The ownership position is this. I take full 100% responsibility for my level of happiness in life. Eleanor Roosevelt once said, no one can make me feel inferior without my permission. That's basically what ownership is. That's the kind of person you want on the job, on your team. That's the person you want to hire. If your questions are creative in the sense that they don't have rehearsed answers for them, you'll get the real person in that interview. You won't get a role-playing event. People will role-play you the same way you role-played when you did your job interview. It's human. It's normal. There's nothing wrong. The problem is we don't know who we have. We end up with someone who role-played us in a job interview, but on the job, they become a completely different person. We feel a little betrayed. We feel confused. We wonder, what are people like these days? You think you've got a good person and they turn around and stab you in the back by bad behavior, by theft, by sabotage, by all kinds of things I hadn't counted on. And the responsibility is really that of the person doing the interview. I want to take extra time. I want to treat my job interview as the most important thing I do because the team that I recruit is going to either make me look great as a leader or make me look terrible. You've probably already been in my seminar about the 6 mistakes managers make and the leadership habits that eliminate them. Well, I want to review those very quickly in a very offhanded way, so that they live for us and we can use them as tools instead of just having them be things that we try to remember. Remember that mistake number 1 is prioritizing being liked. You've got your team in place. You've done great job interviews. You have potential leaders all around you. You have owners in place. Now what do we do? Now how do I lead? The first impulse of a leader is to try to be liked, to have everybody think, well, he's my big buddy, he's my friend, he's not really a manager, he's not like a manager, he's like a buddy of mine, like a drinking buddy or something like that. She's not this, he's not that. The answer to this mistake is very simple. If I keep prioritizing being liked, if I keep trying to be everybody's big buddy, then I will actually lose respect in the long run. What gains respect is by holding people accountable to what they've promised me and by holding myself accountable to what I've promised them. That will gain respect. That'll have me be a completely different person in their eyes as a leader. I need to be very, very careful about just having everyone like me. I want to return my mind to the question of what could I do that would have them respect me? And that leads to mistake number 2. Here's what managers do. They play amateur psychotherapist. They keep trying to figure people out. There's a much easier way to relate to people on your team than trying to figure out what motivates them, trying to play amateur psychotherapist, inviting them in, letting them vent, and then trying to solve their psychology. The simpler way is this. Manage agreements. Have agreements be what the two of you have between each other. Agreements are what bind you to each other. I'm your leader, I'm your manager, and I have created agreements with you, and I will manage the agreements. That's the more adult relationship. That's the more grown-up way to relate. What have you agreed to do? What have I agreed to do? Are you keeping your agreement? Am I keeping my agreement? If not, we need to talk about the agreement. That way, I'm always talking about the agreement that you and I have made with each other. I'm not talking about your behavior. I'm not turning you into a child. I'm not playing parent-child with you. I'm not playing psychotherapist and patient with you. I'm playing two adult professionals managing their agreements with each other. You might show up late for some meeting, and I might ask you to agree to be on time. Can we get an agreement with each other that when we say we're going to meet at 8 o'clock, that we will meet at 8 o'clock, and I can count on that? Can I count on that from you? And if you can't agree to that, what agreement could you keep? And so we keep the discussion on the level of agreements. Then all I have to really manage with other people is agreements. I don't have to manage bad behavior. I don't have to manage bad personalities. I simply manage agreements. It's much simpler, and it wins the respect of my employees. It actually teaches them how to manage their people. I want to insert a tip here that can help you more than just about anything I can think of. During the hiring interview is a wonderful time to get agreements with people because their consciousness is higher, they're ready to promise you anything, and they will remember that interview for the rest of their lives. And so that's a perfect time to say, here's how we do business here. Here's what I expect from people. Would you be able to agree to that? You can even insert things about integrity there. Let's say integrity might be a problem at some location, and you want to correct it. The fastest and best way to correct anything inside the culture, theft, sabotage, integrity, or anything like that, is right there in the job interview. We place a high premium on integrity. Even the smallest thing, even taking a paper clip home, is something we're proud of not doing here. Is that a way you could live? Is that something you believe in as well? Those kinds of questions in a job interview are your very first agreements to manage. They are things that people never forget, and you'll be surprised at how often those promises made in a job interview are kept for the entire time that person is employed. Let's look at habit number 3. The leadership habit is communicating from the future. It's a habit that corrects a mistake. The mistake managers make, usually in their first year of managing people, is that they live in the past. They're always talking about the past. On the telephone, in their email, in their team meeting, they talk about last week, last month, last year, 3 years ago, what this company used to be like, how things were 2 months ago, how things were last year, and they go on and on. It's life in the past. The problem with that is it's not leadership. Leadership is about the future. Keep looking at your communication. Before you send that email to your team, is it a communication about the future? Because that's what the team is looking to you for. What is the future? What can we count on? What's going to happen? Actually, leadership is leadership into the future. That's what it is. Just like a scout leader leads troops into the woods, you lead your team into the future. You're almost like a space traveler coming back from the future to report to your team about what it looks like. That's your communication. The studies that I've done with leaders and managers show very, very clearly that the managers who talk the most, the highest percentage of their communication to their team members about the future, are the managers who have highest productivity. The managers who dwell on the past are the managers who have lowest productivity. Mistake number 4 in our six mistakes that managers make is one that really does huge damage, and so many managers make this mistake. But once you see it, you'll stop making it. The mistake is this: apologizing for change. You see managers do this all the time. "I'm sorry we're doing things a new way. I'm sorry you have to fill the forms out differently. I apologize, I know we were doing them the other way for 2 months and now we're doing them this way. I'm sorry this is happening now. I'm sorry we're doing it differently. I'm sorry life changes. I apologize for that." Now here's the problem with this. Every time I apologize for some change in the company or change in the industry, or change in regulations, or change in policy, I'm actually inviting my people to be victims. I'm actually feeding in to their sense that they are victims of things that shouldn't be happening. I'm actually creating a sense that change should not happen, that change is bad, that staying the same is good. But the truth is not that. The truth is, change will happen, so how can it be bad? If it's a constant, if it will always happen, how can I, as a leader, portray it as bad and have a fired-up team? What I want to do is sell the change. A true leader takes time, understands the change, and explains it and sells it. Here's the reason behind this change. Here's why we're doing this. Here's the good thought behind it. Here's the thing to keep in mind. Every change is done for a reason. Every change is done for the viability of the business. If we're doing things differently, it's because our business is going to be more viable. Our company is going to be stronger from this. No change is because someone just thought up something that was just ugly and horrible and destructive and would really bug everybody if they had to do it. It might look that way, but why does it look that way? It looks that way because I, as a leader and a manager, haven't explained it. I have not sat down and said, "Let me tell you why we're doing this. This is a good thing. This might make us uncomfortable for the moment, but it's going to help us in the long run, and here's how. I'm the person you come to find out how this is going to help us. I'm not going to whine about it myself. I'm not going to say, 'I'm sorry, I apologize.' Every time I apologize, I make my people weak. Every time I apologize, I feed into a self-image that they have as victims. I don't want to do that. I want to explain the change. It takes more courage, it takes more imagination, but it is leadership. Apologizing for change is not leadership." Mistake number 5, running down upper management. It's really tempting to complain about upper management, to worry about upper management, to express confusion, despair about upper management's decision about something. But I have to keep this in mind. If I'm really a leader, and I do that in front of my people, and I let my people hear this, I'm not really a leader. I'm someone who is not leading. I'm someone who is sowing the seeds of low morale, frustration. Now imagine your person going home that night after you've run down upper management and said something negative about upper management, and they go home to their family, and they're saying, "You know, this is such a bad company. It's so frustrating. Even my own manager can't understand why the company is doing this. Even my own manager thinks it's wrong for the company to do this. Even my own manager can't figure out why we're doing this." And now the family says, "Well, why don't you leave? Why don't you quit? It's a horrible place to work." And now this person comes in and quits. And you say, "Hey, how come you're quitting? I can't believe that you're quitting. Here, I hired you, I gave you a good job, and you're quitting? Why are you doing that?" Managers don't see that they are responsible for creating the low morale on their team. It takes a little extra time, a little extra courage to stand up for company decisions. Sometimes it takes the time to find out, why did we make that decision? But I want to make enough phone calls to find that out so I can represent the company. I want to be upper management to my people. I don't want to run down upper management. I want to be the representative of upper management to my people and explain and inspire from that position. That leads us to the final mistake, and that is a basic refusal to be an optimist. Being a pessimist, or even being neutral about the future of our team, the future of our company, where we're headed. If I'm pessimistic or even neutral about that, how are my people going to be fired up? How could they possibly be high motivated, high mood, high feeling, high spirit? How could they be any of that? They can't be any of that if I'm not. They're going to be as excited about the future as I am. So one of the questions that comes up here is, how do I get full staff compliance with all the requests that I make of them? I'm asking them to do certain things. I want them to actually do those things. And it goes back to what we talked about, managing agreements. I want my fundamental agreement between me and my people to be my word. I want the word to be the agreement. In the beginning, there was the word. Your word and my word are the most fundamental agreements we can have with each other. I want you to trust me to do what I say I'm going to do. I want you to hold me accountable as your leader for doing what I say I'm going to do. When I don't do what I tell you I'm going to do, I want you to hold me accountable for that. I want you to ring me up. I want you to call me out. I want you to mention it immediately, and I want to restate my promise. I'll always do what I tell you I'm going to do. But I want that back from you as well. So if you have things to do around your place of business that you've agreed to do, I want to know that your agreement to do them is as good as having them done. I don't want to find out a week or two from now that they weren't done, even though you told me you'd do them. We need a basic meeting if that's happening. And I want to get back to talking to you about trust and communication. Will you do what you say you're going to do? Can I count on you for that? If I can't count on you for that, the most basic agreement between a manager and an employee, what can I count on you for? Not much else. I'd like to finish by thanking you. I want to thank you for listening. I know not everyone takes the time to listen to a tape like this. It says something about you as a leader and as a person. I'd like you to email me 100ways@compuserve.com and tell me your feedback. Let me know what you'd like to hear next month. Let me know the problems you're facing and the fun you're having and the frustration you have, anything that comes to your mind. My commitment is to you, and I promise you I'll do everything I can to make your job more fun and more productive. Thanks again.